Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the midst of our end-of-year pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. For the past 17 years, people across Southern Oregon have lived with the threat of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal, proposed for Coos Bay, and its companion Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline, a 36-inch pipeline that would have traversed 230 miles of Southern Oregon. On December 1st, after years of community organizing, the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and frack gas pipeline project was announced officially dead. Today we talk with some key people who led the struggle to protect Oregon from this massive frack gas project. Allie Rosenbluth is campaigns director with Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Deb Evans and Ron Schaff are landowners whose property would have been impacted by the pipeline. Allie, Deb, and Ron, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And actually, Allie, welcome back, since we were just talking last week as well.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here and talk more with Ron and Deb about this exciting news.
Just to put a frame around how long this process has been going on, I was pulling up my file for the Today Show, which is called Jordan Cove's Definitive Demise. So I was going through all my Jordan Cove shows, I started looking at all these titles. So there was Jordan Cove third time around, and I guess that was the third time the FERC permit, when it was actually approved tentatively. There was Jordan Cove after 16 years, and then a little less than a year ago, there was Jordan Cove's looming demise. So what makes this day different from all the other days that I've talked to Allie and other people, Jody and all the other people that I've talked to about this project that's gone on for so long?
Well, this day, this show has the mark of a ask by the company themselves to vacate the order. And we got that on December 1st. FERC asked the company, what are you going to do? And they sent in their briefing and they said, we do not want to build the project. We want to vacate the order. So it was a very joyous day when we got that news from our attorneys.
I was thinking before we started this interview about how long I fantasized about doing this show. I was talking to Larry Mangan last week, and he said that he feels numb, as well as being overjoyed. He's still numb. And I think, in a way, it's hard to imagine, after thinking about this for so long, that this hopefully would be the outcome of this long struggle, that it's actually here. So how does it hit you guys?
Pretty much the same way the first day or so. Trying to think through what precipitated this move by Pembina. And we had all sorts of theories in our house about what that could be, but it feels 95% over with to me, but I still feel like there's a hanging something out there, but that's just me.
Is it kind of like when you have a limb amputated and you still get phantom pain? I mean, this thing has been with you for so long.
Yeah, and you know, you still don't give up your habits of checking in on the oil and gas industry every morning for about 30 or 40 minutes. So just a little bit unsure about the future in some respects, but definitely a great day.
Well, Allie, you've been in this struggle a little bit shorter than Deb and Ron, but I wonder how it feels to you, because you've been really immersed in this since you got involved with Rogue Climate.
Yeah, it feels really exciting. I think that to me, it feels like Jordan Cove LNG, this iteration of the project, is really done with. And of course, there's so much more work to do to build strong, resilient economies and communities in Southern Oregon and the South Coast. And there's so much work to do that. And there's so much work to continue tracking the fossil fuel industry to make sure that they don't return to our communities and that there aren't other communities where this project goes, and making sure that we're really there to support and to share, you know, all that we've learned with anybody who's facing a calamity like Jordan Cove LNG.
So, Deb, I think I cut you off. You were about to say something.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, you do wait an awful long time for that message. And, you know, I instantly, first it was just yelling and screaming and being so excited. And then you just sort of washes over you how many hours so many people put into this fight. And you know, for us personally, it was pretty much a full-time effort for about 6 years, the last 6 years. And, you know, we thought we had it at round two. FERC, denied the project, and we thought we were done then. We really thought we had won and that it was all over. And so Ron's sentiment is well, we understand that, you know, even though we think sometimes it's over, it's not over. But this feels to me like it's over. And there are a lot of reasons behind that, but it feels really good.
Well, before we talk about why you feel like this time it's really over, I just wanted to give listeners a sort of a sense of how long you've been in the struggle and how you got involved in it in the first place. First of all, where do you live?
Well, we live in Jackson County, and the property that we own that's affected by the Pacific Connector gas pipeline is in Klamath County. And that was a piece of property. It's a timber property that we bought in 2005. And a month after we bought the property, we went over to walk on the property, and we had ideas for a house and different things on it. And we noticed flagging was up on the property, which had not been there prior. And it took us a while to figure out who put the flagging up and what it was all about. But that's when we first learned. So in the summer of 2005, we learned about the Pacific Connector import pipeline that was going to bring gas from Coos Bay to California.
So what did you do when you found out about that?
Well, we did receive a phone call from a land agent representing the pipeline company. And that didn't go well, only because we felt completely intimidated that I felt like they owned our property, not us, because they were telling us that we had no options and this was the plan. And, we had no other choice but to grant them the easement. So that's how we started to get our backs up a little bit.
What did you do next?
So we ended up consulting with a friend of ours from Alaska who's an attorney and said, what do you do when this happens? And he said, hire an attorney and let the attorney handle what needs to happen. So we did. We hired an attorney from Portland. And that person, read all the documents that came in. We really didn't see a whole lot of those documents, but he had the wherewithal to file for us as an intervener. We wouldn't have had a clue how to do that or why to do that. So we were interveners in round one. And, the interesting part about it, like a lot of people, we had three kids. They were all in school at that point in time. We had our hands full with just dealing with our kids and life and everything else. And I think for me, I just pushed it aside and said, this is a crazy idea. It'll never happen. It'll just go away, which was really naive. But that's the way we dealt with round one. And we didn't connect with anybody. We didn't really know what was going on. Ron followed it with the attorney. And then it went away. And I thought, okay, well, we're done, right? Because it went away and went up on the Columbia River, went away, and Bradford Landing. And I just thought, that's the end of it. We won't hear anything else. And we missed the beginning of round two. We didn't file as interveners. We didn't really even know this happened. We decided not to hire the attorney. And so we kind of came in late to the game in round two. And that was at the FERC hearing in Medford, December of 2014. We showed up and we were shocked because we knew we were landowners, but we didn't understand why all the other people were in the building. And that was the beginning of the real process for us.
So what did you find out about all these other people that were in this building?
Well, we listened to their testimony for hours and got a perspective of how they looked at the issue of the pipeline. And we kind of came out of it looking at each other. Man, these people have kind of got our back here. So it changed us completely on kind of looking at what we had to do next. Learn a lot more.
By the time that I started coming down a couple of years ago to really talk with people instead of just following it from a few hundred miles away up in Portland, what I was really impressed by was how much solidarity there was with all the different landowners and how many landowners were involved. I'm wondering, at the time that you got involved back in 2014, was there already that kind of landowner movement to try to stop this the pipeline and Jordan Cove?
That's funny you mentioned that, because we were talking this morning that looking back, we were part of a group that initiated a thing called Hike the Pipe. and it hiked the pipeline route from Malin to Goose Bay. And what we didn't realize is that connected us to a lot of landowners that came out to meet the hikers. And I think that was the point where we were really starting to meet each other. And we carried on from there.
And I would just add that some of the landowners had already connected to each other. Somehow we missed that whole loop. But when we did get involved, which really started in earnest in early 2015, we created a group called Hair on Fire Oregon with some friends of ours. And, you know, what we didn't know, there were sort of two ways to look at the pipeline. One was from an environmental standpoint, and the other was from a private property standpoint. And as landowners, we were as offended by the property rights side of the argument as we were by anything else. But for us, it was really both. It was sort of a double whammy that this wasn't right, and how is this even possible? So one of the early things that we did is we took a list that one of the landowners had created, that he had connected with some of the landowners, and we tried to link that to the pipeline route. In other words, what we wanted to know, the company would not release the names of the people who were affected, which we to this day have a major disagreement on with FERC on that issue alone. But once we figured out how to overlay a county maps, property tax maps with the pipeline route, we were able to secure addresses for every landowner. And that was the beginning of communicating mostly by mail with landowners, and, you know, letting them know about Hike the Pipe. Would they be interested in meeting these hikers? And some said yes, and some said no. And, you know, so all through the process from 2015 on, we have maintained contact with landowners. And from a protection standpoint of landowners and an information, you know, landowners have very little way to get information. And in rural Oregon, where there's very little internet and not everybody has computers or email, it became hugely important to figure out how to let landowners know what was going on, even to comment, whether to FERC or the state or to local permits that were needed. It became this, you know, major effort, which is where also Rogue Climate came in to help organize that effort to reach out to the community and let the community know what was going on.
Well, that segues into the next question I was going to ask, Allie.
Just in addition to the like environmental issues and the landowner issues, unfortunately, someone from representing one of the many tribes who have worked to stop this project wasn't able to join this interview, but there's a really important piece of this project too around cultural resources that the tribes carried through, you know, from 2005 to now. So I just wanted to bring that in and all the gratitude that I know we all have for how the tribes really showed up to help stop this project as well.
And I'm really hoping to get somebody from the tribes to talk in the next few weeks about their perspective, because it goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, unlike the rest of us. Before we continue, actually, we've been using the acronym FERC, and so some people might not know what we're talking about. So, Allie, what is FERC?
FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it is a commission in Washington, D.C. that approves energy projects, including natural gas pipelines and LNG export terminals, like what was proposed in Southern Oregon.
So what role did they have in seeing the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline get approved?
Yeah, so they were the main agency for the federal government for this project. There were, you know, numerous federal permits that Jordan Cove LNG had to get to move forward, but they were the agency that was really like coordinating all of those permits, the draft environmental impact statement, the final environmental impact statement, and then the FERC approval, which is called the Certificate of Need or Public Necessity, is what actually grants the company eminent domain. And so it was a really big one for folks like Ron and Deb. For the project. And so FERC in 2020 approved Jordan Cove LNG, but said because it doesn't have its state permits, the project cannot move forward until it gets those. So when Jordan Covell-Lingee wrote to FERC just last week, saying that they wanted to vacate that permit. That was really huge because not only do they not have their state permits, their local permits, which folks in Coos County fought off for decades, they gave up on the final permit that they did have, and they gave up, they're giving up this power that they have to seize land from property owners in Southern Oregon.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the demise of Jordan Covell-Lingee with Ali Rosenbluth, who's campaigns director with Row Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Deb Evans and Ron Schaff, landowners whose property would have been impacted by the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBU. During our end-of-year pledge drive, KBU's programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Help us reach our $45,000 goal. Join now. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. And thanks for helping us to be able to do this kind of programming, because KBOO was really the first station in Portland, probably the first station in the country that was covering Jordan Cove. Long before I actually started covering it, which was about 12 years ago, we had another programmer, Chris Andre, who was talking to Jody McCaffrey every other week and telling actually some pretty dismal stories back in before 2010. So I wanted to get a sense from you, Deb and Ron, about what it was like in the beginning when it looked like this was a done deal.
Well, when they got their certificate, I'm assuming that's what you're talking about. When they got their certificate, we had major issues with FERC approving that process. And there were a number of reasons for that. The state had already denied the Coastal Zone Management Act permit that they needed, consistency that they needed, and the state had, they had not received their 401 water quality permit, two major permits that states are authorized to give for a project before it can move forward. And so when it passed FERC on a 2-1 decision, two in favor, one dissent, of the commissioners, without a full commission even being in place, we just felt like they weren't looking at the record. We had put endless amounts of stuff in the record, as had many, many other people. The state was against it for the reason that they were conditioning this permit, they were conditioning this project and the certificate on these permits that hadn't been gotten. And yet, as Ali said, our issue was the certificate granted the power of eminent domain. So from March 2020 until now, we've been under the threat of eminent domain. And there's not a day that goes by that we don't know that we could be served papers. And so we went to, you know, we challenged that FERC certificate for a number of reasons. But you know, the main one being that they could grab our land, and if they had done that, they would have gotten to keep the land even if the project had never gone forward. And we just think there's a major error in the system that allows that to happen, and that FERC never should have approved the certificate to start with. And that's why we went to the D.C. Circuit Court to fight that.
Well, actually, you're talking about much more recent than I was thinking. By the time FERC gave the conditional approval of the permit almost a year ago, or actually almost 2 years ago, it seemed like the project was really kind of going through its death rattles, and it hadn't gotten the Oregon permits. Pembina had cut way back in the amount of money that they were spending. There was another time, though, much earlier, before I think any of you were involved, but you've probably heard people who were involved tell this history of when it seemed like it was going to be a done deal, when Jody McCaffrey was kind of fighting this in North Bend a lot on her own with a very small group of people. The common wisdom was that the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal would be built, the pipeline would be built. And I wonder what shifted, what made you all realize that, no, this is not a done deal and we can fight this.
I think there are two, Deb can add what she thinks, but there were two big things that happened that changed our perspective. First was talking to a state politician early on, and he said, "You guys have kind of no idea what you're into here. This thing is huge. This is the biggest project in Oregon history. And you're going to have to think a little bit out of the box if you even want a chance." So we knew we were up against something big. And then second, we were lucky enough to engage FERC with multiple conversations. And that gave us a sense that their policies was what the first thing they said to us is read our policies, which we did. And that started another whole part of our lives, which was all FERC. So we felt like FERC is a big entity and it has a lot of different people on their staff. And the commissioners are political appointments, but the staff are generally career people. So we felt like we were learning a ton from the documents FERC said to read and from some of our conversations about what does a certificate policy statement mean. We asked a million questions. And as a result of that, I think probably no one else spent as much time looking at FERC policy and other decisions to get an understanding of how they work. So Debra can add to that.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't misunderstood earlier. You know, on when we came in, you know, Jody had been working unbelievably hard to try to stop this project. And I think we injected some new energy for one, and we didn't know enough to know what we couldn't do. Right. So we'd never heard anybody say that FERC would maybe deny a project. And everybody else seemed to think that FERC was, you know, all about rubber stamping gas projects. And I think we caught on to that after a while. But we just spent a lot of time just looking at the facts on the ground. Who wanted this project? Why did they want this project? Why was it in the public interest? And I think what we concluded was in digging is we understood that once we read the policy of FERC, as Ron said, and that was pretty late in the game, in October of 2015, the company had written back in November saying we didn't do enough. They had promised to do an open season, and an open season is where they put it out there to any shippers that might want to use the pipeline, and they sign binding contracts to use that pipeline. And this company, Veresen, at that time had put out there that that they wanted shippers on the pipeline, but they didn't ever do an open season. And so we kept saying back to the politicians and back to the powers that be at FERC, how can it be in the public interest if there's nobody who wants to use the pipeline? There's nobody booked on the pipeline. So we pushed that issue. And when they came back and said they'd never done an issue and that, no, the future looks bright and we'll just get our customers later, we worked with a couple of attorneys and frantically put in a letter, because we weren't sure about the timing. We put in a letter in December of 2015 to FERC that said they don't have anything that your policy says they need for you to approve this project. And everybody, you know, sort of, we had over 65 landowners sign on to that letter. And the landowners didn't want it. So that letter got cited in the denial by the FERC commission in 2016. So that win, so to speak, that stopping of the project we understood how FERC worked. We understood what we would need to do to stop the project, which is to show that it wasn't in the public interest.
But I have to say that was a short-lived victory, because that Friday when that decision came out, I immediately called Senator Merkley and Senator Wyden's office. And they were kind of quiet. And I went, uh-oh. And something they already knew was going to happen. The company was going to come back on Monday.
There was somebody who got elected president right about that time.
This was a big, big game, this pipeline project. A lot of people had their card in there somewhere. So I think that was really demoralizing to know that. And we yelled at each other pretty strongly. The staff of both senators, and it was a realization that this is a big, big thing, and just because you had a denial didn't mean anything, really.
Yeah, and I just want to add into the third round of Jordan Cove LNG, when the federal administration was even more about steamrolling communities for fossil fuel projects, we really saw, the coalition as a whole really saw the state as the main target and looking at what powers the state has that precede federal power. So the Clean Water Act, the Coastal Zone Management Act, some authorizations on state lands, and really focused in on those, really focused in on the governor, really focused in on making sure that there was a huge movement of people backing landowners, backing tribal members, backing fishermen up in Southern Oregon and on the South Coast. And we weren't going to let any politician speak favorably about this project without huge accountability. And through that, you know, we saw permit denials that really sealed the deal. And we saw, you know, elected leaders come out and oppose this project, like DeFazio, after supporting it for over a decade. And because we had, you know, really incredibly intelligent people like Deb and Ron and all of the attorneys who helped focusing in on the FERC process and the state permitting process while this, like, you know, huge movement building was happening, we could really hit them from all angles. And because on this third time around we did that and we put everything into every single angle we could possibly think of to stop this project, I think that's why we sealed the deal. And that is thanks to, you know, thousands and thousands of people who sent comments, who showed up to hearings, who, you know, sent emails to their legislators, who showed up to lobby days, who sat in the governor's office, right? There's so many people who are a part of that. And I don't think we'd be at this victory without every single one of those people who helped along the way.
Well, Allie, I'd like to talk a bit about the role that Rural Climate played in all of this. I have a wonderful footage of the hearings and the rallies around the hearings and these great songs that people were singing. And I had the feeling that that was the inspiration of Rural Climate. Am I correct about that?
There were a ton of people and organizations who were part of planning all of those. Rural Climate got to really play the role of coordinating all of that and bringing people together and like bringing out the best of ideas that people had. But there's no one organization or one group of people or one person who did this. All of it was a collaborative effort, and that's why we were so successful.
Well, one of the senses I got from talking to Larry Mangan, the landowner in North Bend, he was describing the way that basically you and Hannah, who is the executive director of Rural Climate, I think he referred to you as like the mother hens. But you'd come in, you'd kind of take care of people, and you gave them a certain kind of emotional support. And here are all these landowners who were just run ragged by this horror of this thing dragging on for years and years and years, and you were this kind of fresh energy. I wonder if you saw yourself in that role, and if you saw that you had a certain kind of nurturing ability that was maybe a little bit harder for the landowners who were just going through hell.
Oh, it's really great to hear that that's the impact that Larry felt. And I think you know, that probably came out of just like really caring about people and caring about the way that they were impacted and the things that they wanted, that they dreamed of for their homes that were being stopped by this project, and seeing people's real humanity, no matter where they fell in the political spectrum, just knowing that we all love where we live and want to protect it, and really leaning into that. And, you know, some of, I've made some incredible friends and people who now feel like family to me through this campaign. And I think there are so many other people who feel the same way about, you know, the people that they've spent years working on this project with. So I really think that, you know, what Rural Climate did was really help bring out the best in people and help support people, especially when it comes to organizing and like building the movement that could stop this project.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KUBU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the final demise of Jordan Cove LNG with Allie Rosenbluth, campaigns director with Rural Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Deb Evans and Ron Schaff, who were landowners whose property would have been impacted by the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And again, I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our end-of-the-year pledge drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of our listeners are members. So help increase our member ratio and help us reach our $45,000 goal by going to kboo.fm kboo.org/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. You mentioned, Ali, the diversity of the people who were involved in this fight, particularly the landowners, who not only represented the spectrum of the population ranging from Malin, which is sort of what, south central Oregon, very close to the California border, all the way to Coos Bay. There was a geographic diversity, also, I guess, a lot of political and social diversity. So how did all these people come together?
Well, I'll maybe take a crack at that. For landowners, it was really interesting. I mean, what we had in common was we didn't want the pipe. And since a lot of us had been offered a pittance for the easements early on, I think it just made everybody realize that, you know, there was no money in it early on, and why should we sign and bring these risks onto our property? So we felt like once we started connecting after Hike the Pipe with different landowners, it was just a fascinating process. Yeah, politically, we were all over the map. And I think what we figured out long time ago was, you know, if you want to bring a community together, try to put a pipeline through it, because people were very, very against this pipeline. Not everybody, but the people that, you know, sort of congregated in our world of landowners were as diverse as they come, but we, you know, became good friends through the process of really learning about each other and respecting each other's opinions of why we were against the pipeline.
I grew up in Oregon and I lived in a rural area, East Side, Bend. And when I first met some of the people on the pipeline, I was a little intimidated by this type of rural Oregonian. And it took me a while to figure out how to listen and hear what they wanted to say. And I'd also say, in the end, now, well, as Deb said, we're friends with many of them. Will we ever be friends forever? Probably not. We'll just kind of go back to our lives, but in some respects. But I think thinking about a number of landowners that didn't sign that we've never met, and how do they see Oregon? How do they see their lives in these really rural areas? So I'm still learning about people that wanted to say no, but didn't need to talk to anyone else about that. So that was another contingent of our diverse group.
There's a diversity in political spectrums between the landowners and a lot of class diversity there as well. There's also a huge diversity in this coalition. There were tribal members, you know, communities from all across Southern Oregon. And, you know, there were some urban folks, right, who, like from Portland, who were, you know, throwing down to help stop the project up north, where there's even more political power. And so I think when we're bringing together such a wide perspective, or such a wide variety of perspectives, it's really important that, like, everybody feels heard for the reasons why they're coming to the table, and that you listen, you have real conversations with folks, and when the opportunity arises, you make sure that their voices, especially those people who are directly impacted, have a seat at the table and are, you know, supported in being spokespeople and sharing their stories, and supported in, you know, the meetings with the governor's staff and the agencies and so on and so forth. So I think it's really about having real conversations with people, meeting people where they're at, and bringing them along the way.
And let me add to that, you know, we did a tour for the governor's office of rural landowners. One of the governor's high up staff traveled with us, and we rode in a van together, and he got to sit next to a lot of different rural landowners and hear their stories and then meet them on their own properties. I think that was quite an experience. And I think that helped in the end for the governor's office to see and experience what rural Oregon looks like. So that was another big part of that.
Well, Ron, you were saying that you don't know if you'll remain friends with some of these people that you met through the years of struggle, but I'm wondering what kinds of ways it transformed you to get to know these people who had such different backgrounds than you, and if maybe something has changed in the way you may relate to rural Oregonians who more reflect those values in the future.
Yeah, it's complicated depending on the individual you're talking to. So trying to see life through their shoes their rural experiences that were even different than mine. So listening and paying attention to their struggles and the way they look at the world. Deb and I consider ourselves environmentalists, and so do these landowners in a lot of respects. So they were making their statement in their own way. I think of Frank Adams putting his no LNG stop Jordan Cove sign in the back of his truck for years, and no one knew Frank other than a few people in Douglas County. So everyone was out there. Deb can add to that, but it was quite an eye-opener to start to have dialogues where you could open up to each other a little bit.
I mean, I think of Frank, and I think, you know, one of the most powerful things was that he's a Vietnam vet, right? And, you know, I had great respect for the people that we met along the way. I do think that we'll remain friends with most, if not all of them, because we just went too much together, right? But people are getting older, right? I mean, there was this worry on our part that, you know, as people got older, their health was frail. Would they see the end of this? And, you know, Frank was one of the first calls we made, John Clark, a few other people that, you know, some people that we know over in Klamath County, I've called, you know, all of them and talked to them. And, you know, it's powerful because the emotional toll on, I mean, really everybody in Southern Oregon, but I think the landowners sort of had a unique fear of what was going to happen to their properties. And because our property didn't have our home on it, it put us in a little bit different category. I mean, the people that I felt most sympathetic with were the people who it was going to go right next to their house, unbelievably close to their house, in fact. And I didn't understand how in the world FERC could approve a project that, you know, in rural Oregon, where there's lots of space, you could have gone over the mountaintop, you could have gone somewhere else and not right between two people's homes. You know, even now, I think that that's wrong. And I think that there needs to be a lot more vetting of how they pick these routes. And it became clear to us that part of it is around people who are on fixed income, people who probably can't fight the pipeline fight. And, you know, that offended us on every level. And I think at one point, I remember looking at Ron going, you know, I guess this is how we're going to spend our money. Instead of building a house on our property, we're going to put it into the pipeline fight. And it's been a big cost to us, you know, but we had means and we decided that was how we were going to spend it. Somebody had to step up to the plate. And so people put in their time, they put in their, you know, blood and sweat through all of this. And Allie had it right. Every voice counted. Every voice mattered in this. It didn't matter the reason why you were opposed. If you spoke out and you wrote a letter and you put your name, you know, in saying, I don't want this. I feel what Oregon did absolutely best as we went through the different iterations of this project, by round three, a lot more people knew about it and a lot more people were informed to the point where they could speak intelligently to why this made no sense for Oregon. And that message came through loud and clear at hearings. It came through in every way possible. It came clear to the state, and it didn't meet the laws of Oregon to approve this project. So they stood on the laws of Oregon, not just because we asked them to not approve it. They actually went through the due diligence and said, no, we can't do this because it doesn't meet our laws. And so for the company to try to skirt around that and go above Oregon to the federal government and see if they could get the 401 waived or the CGMA consistency waived, then, you know, that to me was just another example of the company didn't really care much about Oregon. It cared about its bottom line and its profit.
One of the things we haven't mentioned, but you've sort of alluded to it, how many different companies own this project from the beginning to the end? You mentioned Verizon, who was the owner before Pembina, but it goes way back. I don't even remember how many.
Started with a small company called Fort Chicago.
And that was a Canadian company that had built a pipeline down from Canada down to the U.S., the Alliance Pipeline. And so they got involved first at the bidding of the International Port of Coos Bay, looking for an anchor shipper. to ship out of Coos Bay. And so Fort Chicago got involved. They involved another company that helped them, you know, in the beginning. And then when the import went started to go south, and Oregon asked FERC to vacate an early certificate because of fracking in this country and not needing that gas to come in from the outside, then they reorganized under the name Veresen, and they proposed the export project. And then Pembina came in basically after the election, when Trump got elected. Then Pembina decided that this would be something they were interested in pushing. They had deeper pockets and they thought they could get it across the finish line. So they announced that they were going to buy Veresen. And that deal came to fruition right after Veresen put in the application to FERC. Then the deal was sealed and Pembina became the new owner in 2000.
And all of these companies are actually Canadian companies. And I mean, there's an interesting thing there because there's a lot of fracking going on in Canada and they don't know what to do with the gas. And this is one of the ways to get that gas from the central prairie area in Alberta, and actually some in eastern British Columbia, to their markets that they want to ship to in Asia.
And I just want to also just raise up the pipeline fight, Wet'suwet'en, fighting a really similar project, a frack gas pipeline that would go to an LNG export terminal, and just knowing that a lot of people in Canada, especially First Nations people, are experiencing the same fight, the same hardships that we experienced fighting Jordan Cove LNG, and that right now, you know, construction is happening for a lot of those projects in British Columbia. And if there's any way folks can support those efforts, whether it's making a donation or going up to be there with folks to help fight those pipelines, that's really huge right now as well.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking about the definitive demise of Jordan Cove LNG, and we've been talking with Ali Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director with Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Deb Evans and Ron Schaff, who are landowners whose property would have been impacted by the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our end-of-year pledge drive. KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. Please support this vital community institution and help us reach our $45,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Ali, I want to talk a bit more about some of the focus that Rogue Climate brought to this struggle, because Rogue Climate has been largely involved with sustainable energy and climate change and trying to transform communities to be more resilient and sustainable. And how did that fit into the fight with Jordan Cove? And did you find that there were some challenges in bringing climate issues to the wide diversity of opinions that were amongst the landowners fighting the pipeline?
Well, Rogue Climate decided to join the fight and to prioritize stopping Jordan Cove LNG when we were first formed in about 2014. Just thinking that if we're not able to stop fossil fuels in our communities while we're transitioning to clean energy, we're really failing to meet the climate goals that we need to meet to have a livable future. So it has always been a priority of Rogue Climate to stop this project. And because, you know, Rogue Climate is made up of Southern Oregonians, many who live rurally, many whose families have, you know, lived rurally for decades. We knew how to talk to our neighbors about the project. We knew not to often start with climate change, but we also like to take the risk of bringing it in and having conversations with people. And I remember talking with landowners who, you know, didn't necessarily believe climate change was human caused, but could list, you know, 30 ways their ranch had been impacted by climate change in the last 10 years. And so it was really important to bring that in. And it was also really important because it helped people all across the state and the region see their stake in this project as well. And because it helped pressure the state. The state of Oregon has huge climate commitments that it's failing to meet. And this project, we made really clear, was going to push them even further away from that. So we can't have climate justice in Southern Oregon with Jordan Cove LNG. We know we can't have climate justice in the world without stopping fossil fuel projects from expanding or being new ones being built. And so it's really important while we're working on solutions to also be making sure that we're stopping the bad.
Well, do you feel like it was a shift in mindsets in some people, that maybe people who started out thinking climate change was not human caused might be thinking differently now?
I think so. You know, I think we've also like humanized the issue too. Like people know, like they have friends who, you know, have dedicated a lot of their lives to climate change. And I just think about how this campaign has really been able to connect so many folks in rural Southern Oregon to the climate movement all across Oregon. I remember, for instance, going to our Children's Trust rally with John Clark, who's a landowner in Douglas County, and, you know, seeing Deb and Ron at clean energy bill hearings in Salem, right? And so because we had faced this huge fossil fuel project in our communities, it became even realer for rural Oregonians. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so many people in our community who are, you know, advocating for clean energy, because we know what the alternative looks like, and it's not pretty, whether it's the climate impacts, the impacts to our rivers, the impact to cultural resources, or the impacts to private property. Fossil fuel projects hurt us in a lot of ways, and we have really fortunately not experienced it because we stopped the project, but we lived for, you know, decades with the fear that it could happen. And so it's really real to us. And I think it's really important that people understand the stake and the care that so many rural Oregonians have for fighting back against climate change.
Well, now that Jordan Cove is no longer hanging over everybody's head the way that it has for 17 years, where do you go from now? Besides raising a glass, I'm sure you're still raising a few glasses. It's only been less than a week since the news broke. But where are you going to focus now that you don't have to spend all your energy fighting something bad?
Well, I was going to say, I'll take a crack at that. You know, we've been doing a little bit of thinking. We haven't solidified on anything exact yet, but there's a couple of things in the process that have to happen to, you know, make this a reality, right? So the company has asked to vacate the order. Technically, FERC has to ask the DC Circuit Court for permission to vacate the order. DC Court has to give them that permission, and then FERC issues an order that vacates the order. So there are a few people who are holding out for that moment to pop the champagne cork. But I think for us, you know, I've started thinking more and more about working with other landowners across the country who have fought their own fights. Some of them have gone by the wayside, Atlantic Coast Pipeline and Penn East Pipeline. And there's a group of us that, you know, have all been through the same experience, and we don't want other people to have to go through that experience. So our own Senator Ron Wyden has a bill, 641, Senate Bill 641, Landowners Fairness Act, which we believe has a lot of very good things in it that would finally protect landowners from these land grabs by corporate interests. And, you know, we believe strongly that our constitutional rights are at stake, and that somebody, Fifth Amendment right for needs to be upheld and needs to be solidified, apparently, because FERC can still interpret it the way it wants. And we would like to see that change and directive given to FERC so that this does not continue to happen to landowners.
How about you, Ellie? What are your sights set on now?
Yeah, so we definitely need to spend lots of time celebrating. This was such a long and hard fight. I just want everybody to like take the time to like pat themselves on the back and like smile and just really feel the work that they did and how incredible it was and that we got here. So I don't want to underplay that. But also there's, you know, work to do. Protecting the Coos Bay Estuary from, you know, similar dredging projects that would have, you know, similar harm to the fishing community and cultural resources and climate change, right? Really making sure that we are protecting Coos Bay as much as possible. from development that could do similar harm. There's lots of work to transition to clean energy that is just and affordable, helping people reduce their energy usage so that we can meet these goals. There's so much work that we're doing to respond to the fires that happened in Jackson County in 2020 and preparing our communities for the impacts of climate change between drought and wildfire and so much more. So we are really excited to continue our work. And we're going to continue to stay vigilant, right? We need to make sure that there's no new proposal that pops up. We're not going to have a fourth iteration of Jordan Cove LNG. And if we do, we're going to kill it really fast. And that we have to make sure that we are, as a state, transitioning off of fossil fuels, transitioning off of fracked gas in our homes and in our buildings and in our electric grid. So, you know, we have been doing that work while we've been stopping Jordan Cove. And now we're excited that we have even more capacity to put into it. And really, you know, for the next year or so, hopefully, celebrate this incredible victory and tie up any of these loose ends that might remain.
Well, I'm thinking about how people felt so powerless at the beginning of this struggle. And the same thing was true in Astoria when they were fighting off a whole slew of LNG export, well, first import and then export terminals. What does victory give you in terms of a sense of empowerment?
Not so sure. I think there are so many parts to climate change that are not happening as a country and a state. And I think having been in this fight and seen what the personally you can do, I've sort of taken on the idea of my own climate change movement, improving my ability to be better at lowering my carbon footprint. So we are in the wealthy class, and the wealthy take most of the climate and use it to their advantage. So personally, the two of us are trying to get our carbon footprint under 3 like others. And so that's a day-to-day thing. So that'll carry on for the rest of our lives.
How about you, Allie?
Yeah, I think this win really shows us that when communities come together, we can win. And that's the reminder that we need every day when we are fighting for climate solutions. And I hope that this win can reverberate out across the country and the world and help inspire other communities who are facing similar projects that, with a lot of work and a lot of coming together and fighting, we can eventually stop these projects, and we know we have to, and so we're going to.
It's an interesting thing that when I go through my day now, I'll be doing something, and then I'll just have this flash that the project is over. And, you know, we waited so long to be able to have it be over that it just brings a huge smile to my face and this flood of relief again that it's not there anymore, that this thing that we've been pushing so hard against for, you know, 7 years and 16 years altogether is gone. So I think it's going to come in waves, that it's going to, you know, keep coming as a very pleasant reminder that it's done.
Well, Allie, Deb, and Ron, it's great talking with you. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus, and thanks so much for this long struggle that you have been waging, and I'm so glad that it's been a success.
Thank you, Barbara. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Allie Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Deb Evans and Ron Schaff, who helped lead the fight to stop the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during our end-of-the-year pledge drive by becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Help us reach our $45,000 goal. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about plans to expand fossil fuel development in rural Columbia County along the lower Columbia River. We'll go out with sounds of protest against Jordan Cove LNG at the Oregon State Capitol 2 years ago. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.